Welcome to an all-new episode of the McFuture Podcast. I'm Steve Factor, and today I have a very special guest. And really, this episode kicks off a series that is going to be very controversial on the future of belief. Now, for anyone who's been listening to this podcast, could pretty much guess I'm not a very religious person. And by not very religious, I don't believe in anything. However, well, that's not true. I probably believe in a few things. I believe in love. I believe the children are our future. There are things I believe in, but not really in formal religion. So it's kind of odd that I'm going to be doing an entire series on the future of belief. Well, next week, I'm going to get into exactly what that means and why it's important. Because something that we're all witnessing right now is how unimportant empirical truth is and how much of a role belief is playing in our lives. And I'm going to make that case next week. But today I'm going to play you a spectacular conversation that I had live in person with one of the most prominent religious leaders in the country, Pastor A.R. Bernard. He's the founder of Christian Cultural Center here in New York, which has over 40,000 members. And he's incredibly influential in not only the Black community here, but nationally with Denzel Washington, Oprah, and all these celebrities. And he's an advisor to Michael Bloomberg. Now, we got into a really interesting conversation about Michael Bloomberg's stop and frisk and what the pastor has to say about all of that, which was fascinating. That is on the member exclusive episode on Patreon. So follow the show notes. There's a link there at patreon.com/McFuture. If you join for $5 a month, you'll get all this awesome extra material. We had probably about a 30-minute Q&A, and that entire Q&A is there live right now for you to listen to on Patreon. Anyway, this was a spectacular conversation. Now, if there weren't so many secularists and atheists and all these godless, horrible New Yorkers in the crowd, I'm pretty sure that the pastor would have converted every single one of them to his church. And that wasn't the goal. The goal was really just to discuss the future of belief. But it was so insightful and so thoughtful. I think you're going to love it and you're going to fall in love with the guy. Now, if you do, please keep in mind he's a married man. He's got 24 grandkids. So leave the pastor alone. Anyway, here's the conversation I had with the pastor. Enjoy.
Welcome, Pastor.
Thank you. Done a great job of creating chaos.
Thank you.
I was like, is he going to escape? He's sitting awfully close to the door. I started to worry. No pressure at all. Hold on. Let me get my questions.
You have me taking notes because...
Oh, really? To refute my
thesis? Well, you've redefined religion, redefined faith, redefined truth.
So you have to fix me now.
Gosh, it becomes a testimony to how broken we are as human beings and how much of a crisis we're in terms of identity and purpose and things that people naturally look for.
So just before we dive in, because you obviously, if you're taking notes, I want to give you a chance to kind of, you know, dump on me if you have to. Just tell me what you thought and maybe initial reaction, just because I know you have a unique perspective on these things.
Well, you know, when you think about religion, you seem to have implied in your presentation that religion has moved from a search for meaning and purpose and the divine to causes, and causes are replacing religion. I differ with that, of course.
Okay.
Also, going back to, and I watch his program every chance I get, but the whole idea that truth is empirical, personal, and political,
yeah,
redefines what truth is. So, you know, what definition are we working with when we talk about truth? It's
how become, do you think about it?
Well, truth can't be subjective. Truth has to be objective, free from our personal opinions and feelings and ideas. Truth has to be transcendent. It has to be true for all people at all times, in all places, if it's truth. Truth has to be absolute. It cannot smack of any imperfections that are based upon our skewed perceptions or feelings and ideas for it to really be truth. So I think, you know, that becomes problematic when we have these versions of truth.
But don't you have a personal truth? If you believe in God and someone else doesn't, don't you already send information from the outside world through that filter?
Well, again, truth cannot be invented. It's discovered. It's something that exists long before we get here or we even know it. Truth has to have that type of infinite continuity. It cannot be something that we decide on. Again, it's discovered. So when we take a truth and we make it personal or private or try to privatize it, then it loses its transcendence.
Well, that makes me think of when we met at your office, and you told me how you've evolved over time, and you probably went through a few different types of truth. So, for example, you were in Nation of Islam for a while, and then you moved out of that. You know, I think you were young and rebellious. And so tell me how, but you did experience a personal truth evolution, did you not?
No. It wasn't a personal truth. It spoke to, look, I grew up in the 60s. And, you know, late 50s and 60s, at a time that in America there were every revolution imaginable going on in this country, spiritual, music, political, military, industrial complex. I mean, it was going on and on and on. And I grew up without a father, so single-parent home. And I grew up white father, white Spaniard father, my mother, African, descendant of slaves that were brought to the Caribbean. So I was what would be called mulatto. So in my time, it was I was too light to be black and too dark to be white. So I had to live in this tension and identity crisis where I had to make a decision. Who am I? What am I going to identify with? And I ended up identifying with the West African diaspora. The Nation of Islam came into play because I saw in the Nation of Islam order, discipline, sense of identity. I saw strength, things that I as a young man needed. But I didn't find what I felt was absolute truth. I found an expression of protest against the failure of white America to deal with the socioeconomic plight of blacks in this country. I found a context in which religion of various types were woven together to be part of a system of thought that was presented there. I never bought into the idea of white people being the devil and scapegoating.
Thank God. I was going to move a little further over
didn't do
to
that.
The edge.
I believe it was systems, structures, racially explicit policies, an America that was founded on white nationalism and had to develop because of the influx of people that were different or the emergence of people who were marginalized, whether they were white indentured servants, Indians who were indigenous to the nation, or African-American slaves that were brought over, child labor. You know, I had to put all of that journey in perspective. So I continued to search because I felt the truth, God, the divine, the transcendent, and reality were one and the same. So if I found one, the other two should be present. That was not true of my experience in the Nation of Islam.
Well, why did you leave?
Why did I leave the nation? Because
yeah.
I continued looking. I continued searching. Like I said, I did not find the description of truth that I shared with you in that context. And I found myself being courted in strange ways by Christianity. A Christianity that was different than the Christianity that I grew up with, because I grew up Catholic. A Christianity that gave a sense of transcendent purpose and culminated in the revelation of a person, and that is the person of Christ. So it was less about the institution of Christianity as manifested in its churches. It was more about this individual and the message, the character, the revelation of in this individual that brought me to a different perspective on my own self. Because foundationally, it began resolving the identity crisis by giving me the belief that we are all, as human beings, stamped by the image of God, which means that our worth, our dignity, our value is because we're human.
Yeah.
So it's not about race or class or education or anything like that. And I think that's very important because it then levels the playing field. And I can then build from there.
I've softened up on religion lately just because, you know, seeing things through this lens, I see the need more so than I ever did before in terms of why people seek out faith. Because I see people manifesting it in the ways that I described earlier. The question then is, when someone doesn't see it your way, does not believe, or does not believe in Christ specifically, maybe they're of a different faith. This kind of reminds me of a Richard Dawkins quote. So he's a famous atheist, for those of you who don't know. He said that every religious person is an atheist towards other religions. So you're not believing in the God of other faiths. You believe in your God. So you're simultaneously a believer and a non-believer, but the non-belief is towards others. How do you respond to that, and what's your take on that perspective?
Well, I appreciate further confusion. but the reality is that I can respect and appreciate what you believe and the journey that took you there. That's okay with me. I have to sort of distinguish myself from what may be perceived as fundamental evangelical notions of the Christian faith. Christianity, the beauty of it for me is mystery. Unlike the Western Christianity that we are accustomed to here in America and most of Europe, the Bible is an Eastern book. And whereas here in America we want certainty, we want resolve and, you know,
results,
finality and solution to life, the Bible doesn't present that. It leaves a lot open to be explored, to journey through. And I think that if ever we get to the place where we can fully explain God, he's no longer God. We have stripped him of his transcendence. We have stripped him of mystery. Can you imagine in our finite mind, and we as human beings, we can be quite arrogant, you know, if we subscribe to an ultimate power and personal being, and I embrace a personal being because I'm personal, and I can only think that whoever or whatever created this, all right, judging by the creation itself, and if I'm personal and self-aware and self-transcendent and have the power of reason, etc., that whoever created all of this has to share, if not not share, but be the source of what I experience on a much, much larger scale.
It's interesting. When I went to your service on Sunday, this was after the holiday, after, it doesn't matter. My calendar is a little jumbled right now. But what was interesting, the sermon that you gave would not have been out of place in a Tony Robbins context. Or, you know, so you spoke about the different types of love that people experience between mother and child or siblings and so on. And you use that as a platform to talk about forgiving yourself for sometimes not helping someone fully or getting them completely out of their whatever situation they may be in. I thought it was really insightful, really thoughtful, really interesting. You sprinkled a little bit of God in there, but if I did a little bit of
a
editing,
a little bit of
no,
God.
No. You did. It wasn't no. Because
you're gonna get me in trouble with my congregation.
No, okay. I'm not trying to get you in trouble. No, but the point is for a guy like me who doesn't typically engage with religious content and religious ideas or religious leaders, hearing you talk that way was no, you didn't convert me. But you, I was able to hear your message in a way that was not clouded by the fact that I was in a giant church, you know, or the fact that the person who was speaking is a pastor. So do you think that's where religion has to go in general, and maybe Catholicism, into this sort of almost, I don't want to use self-help because it's too simplistic and narrow, but I think this utility type of thing where you're actually using these ideas and implementing them in your relationships and how you engage with people and not so much make it, you know, God did this and God did that, which is how I typically saw it, but it was you. You can do this. These are the things, how you should interact with others and the world. So is that the transition? Is that the difference where you see things going?
I think that what I do is make it practical and socially applicable. As I said, Christianity is a person, all right, more than it is a set of ritual and practice. It's a person. So what we believe is that if God were human, he would be like Christ. So as we examine his life, his words, his interactions with people, it begins to model the transcendent to us and that perfect coming together of divinity and humanity. All right, so now it challenges me because it sets a standard of thinking and living. You know, especially take, you know, Jesus said, love your enemies. Wow. You know, especially now with the deep divide in our nation. You know, what does that look like? How do we engage that? Dr. King bought into that idea, which really was the impetus for the civil rights movement, at least his participation at that time in the civil rights movement's journey. So for us, you know, God is represented in the person of Christ. How did he interact with people? You know, what was his message? Was it one of empowerment or was it one of strictly judgment and condemnation? And the answer is no. So I think even today, people, especially millennials, they're looking for their faith experience to be relevant. What do we mean by that? Again, practical. I can apply it in my relationships, my marriage, raising my children, managing my money, my affairs, you know, but also socially applicable. It must give me a lens through which I can make sense of the world around me. Because Christianity is also a worldview. So when we go back to religion, and let me say this about spirituality, because we now live in at a time when people are saying, well, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual.
Brittany and Tiffany.
The problem is, what does that mean? How do we understand that? How do we you know, quantify that, qualify that? How do we pass that from generation to generation? I would say that spirituality, and they say this to sort of distance themselves from the failure of organized religion to answer some of the big questions. And remember, for a long time, especially in Christian faith and the three Abrahamic faiths, which you experience as well in Judaism, it was about, well, this is what it is, do this.
Right. It's very definitive. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, but that's monologue. This generation wants dialogue. They want conversation. Include me. I want to ask questions. I want to understand this. I want to be able to challenge it and think differently. And I think that's necessary, important, and it should happen.
That's what turned me off the most when I went to yeshiva, because the minute I said, how could Noah live for 950 years? I was out of class immediately. Because I'm like, the rabbi was walking me out, I was like, if you look pretty bad after 100, imagine how bad you look after 900. And then out, back to the principal's office.
But there are reasonable explanations to these things. There's reasonable conversation to be had about longevity and the fact that it has, from the biblical record, decreased over time. You know, the experience of new diseases and new medical and physical challenges. I mean, we could and we should have that conversation. You also, in your slide, if I may continue my critique.
I didn't know this was going to happen. This is unacceptable, Pastor.
You disconnected reason from faith, and as though belief is something that is now passé, and reason, or the restoration of enlightenment, you know, is what's going to take us out into the future. But I will tell you, in the context of my Christianity, faith is a reasoned trust. You talked about promises that were made. You talked about your apocalyptic vision requiring a divine intervention of God to make the world a better place. And faith, especially the Abrahamic faith, has lived in the tension between that apocalyptic vision and progressive social reform engagement, what you would call tikkun olam, repairing the world, and our role in that repairing of the world in a broken human society. So I think that it begins not with religion, it begins with spirituality. We are religious because we're spiritual.
Explain that to me. Okay. Like I'm fine.
So what is spirituality? Spirituality is, we're born spiritual in that we are born with certain attributes that are not material or physical. I was ambushed. That's the better word for it. I was ambushed. I was invited to Washington, D.C. to be on a friend of mine's television show. It was a town hall meeting. And he said, you know, I just want you to come down and talk about faith. When I got there, I was opposite two atheists, two agnostics, and what was the other one? A skeptic.
Right. There's a few in the room.
And, you know, but it was fun. I enjoyed it. And they were all within a range, age range of 25 to 38, which I thought was cool, too. And we started to have a conversation. And sitting next to me was the scientist. He was a neuroscientist. And he grew up in a home where parents were evangelical. The old, this is it, and, you know, or God's going to get you. And it turned him off. And he wanted to have a reasonable conversation about that faith and those beliefs. And, of course, that was rejected. So it kind of shaped and fashioned his rejection of organized religion and put him on a track that would lead to empirical evidence to satisfy his questions. And science gave that to him. But as we got into the conversation, we talk about spiritual and what does that mean? We're born with certain spiritual attributes, right? Such as reason, the power to collect information, come to conclusions, come to judgments, the power of self-awareness. You know, we're talking transcendent here. Self-awareness, self-identity that's unique and different from everyone else. The whole idea of self-transcendence, our ability to, with our minds, travel into the past, relive it, and also to imagine the future. And by extension, go out into that future with our minds. This is transcendent. This is part of who we are. A sense of morality, this idea of right and wrong, good and evil, and what we build into our society of boundaries for etiquette and respect, et cetera. I mean, these are transcendent values. Even the atheist has to say, without a moral value consensus within society, you know, and an appreciation for human life, we have chaos.
Can we have morality without God?
If we define morality, rules of right and right and wrong conduct as transcendent, because to be truly moral, all right, it has to transcend any one cultural context or any set of laws within a society, all right, then that morality has to come from someone greater than us, higher than us. I mean, Dr. King was effective in appealing to the conscience of America by declaring racism as immoral. See? So all of American society up to that point, its laws, its policies, reinforced segregation, Jim Crow, racial discrimination. But now he appeals to this transcendent idea that what you're doing and thinking and practicing is immoral, which means it's immoral here in America, it's immoral in South Africa, immoral in Europe, at the Berlin Wall. Now we're talking about something that is much higher than this realm of what we create called culture. Must come from something or someone transcendent, above all of us.
You know, you kind of touched on identity, and that's something I wanted to talk to you about. We're living in a time now where people are very, I wouldn't say consumed, but it's top of mind, and it's all over the news in terms of how people identify, how we view each other. And, you know, we have, you know, identity politics, as you're, I'm sure, aware. What do you think of the conversations we're having? Because I'll give you my perspective, and I'd love your thoughts. Because I think we're being a bit reductive. So when I meet an individual, my goal is to treat them the way I would want to be treated. So my goal is to judge them based on their ideas, their actions, who they are as a person, and so on. It seems pretty straightforward, right? But I feel like now there's a lot of people politically that will now pre-categorize you in a biased way based on your intersectional membership cards. And I think that does an injustice and reduces people to immutable traits in a way that doesn't give them the dignity and respect of individuality. And I'd love to know your thoughts on it and where that dialogue is today and maybe where it has to go in order for it to work for us as a society.
Sounds like a 20-minute speech that was given in Washington, D.C. in 1960 by a man named Dr. Martin Luther King, right? What do you say? That we can be judged not by the color of our skin or class or anything like that, but the content of our character.
But we've gone in a different direction.
Yeah, we are product of a culture that, in order to resolve the identity crisis that's common to all human beings, all right, we're born with that and we have to work through that crisis and land somewhere. We're in a place where we are finding that resolution by taking sides against something else. So it's less about what I'm for. It's more about what I'm against.
It's so French of us. It's the most French thing about
freedom,
America.
Freedom, justice,
except
and
our
fraternity, right? That's what the French said, and yet the fraternity has been difficult for the French and everyone else.
We're this close to throwing tomatoes.
Yeah. So I think that, number one, as I said, the identity crisis is common to every individual. I mean, going up in as a child and then into adolescence, once you reach adolescence and transition into your teen years, where do you engage then? You're really trying to find, who am I? What's my distinction? And often we want to break away from the identity that was given to us by our parents to forge our new path. And as we grow older, we realize how much we're like our parents, and we get mad at that, you know. So it is a journey, but we have to come to some place where we decide, okay, what's my true worth, dignity, and value going to be measured by? And I believe that it begins with the life, worth, and dignity of the human person. All right, so when we begin to see ourselves as human beings and part of the human family, without all the other stuff that we wrap it up in, then we could begin to have a conversation of what's really important. What I love about Christianity is that it gives society a transcendent purpose. It's called the common good. We can debate about what the common good is, but it is still an idea with great power that should inform us as we interact with each other.
When you think about this identity crisis, you know, the quote that I keep coming back to, and I know this isn't the original text, but the devil makes work for idle hands. And how much of this identity struggle that we're having do you think is related to the fact that we're not being asked a lot by society? We don't have to spend our days on survivalist tasks. And so we have the capacity to essentially create problems for ourselves and create complexity where there was none, because a lot of those problems, the survivalist ones, have been solved. So are we creating problems for ourselves? Like, what is the, you know, what is your take on that? That's my theory, and I'm sticking to it until you...
Interesting. I was reading where up until the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989 to 1991, you know, 70 years of a socialist experiment, and the years post-World War II, you know, the United States as a nation representing the West and Soviet Union and its bloc countries, the United States and its allies representing the West, Soviet Union, East, there was this tension between East versus West. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, it had a negative impact on the United States in that we no longer had an enemy.
Right.
And it speaks of a national level, and I think it also translates to an individual level. When we don't have an enemy, when we don't have an opposition, when we don't have something to challenge us that forces us to be disciplined, that forces us to engage in serious thought, we become apathetic, we become lazy, we become undisciplined, and then we begin to take the energy that would have been invested in dealing with those enemies, those oppositions, those challenges, and we turn it into play, and we find new ways of recreation. And our ingenuity and creativity is spent on recreation. So we have a multi-billion-dollar entertainment industry in the West, you know, in Europe, here, all over, and now it's global, and we become occupied with that, and we lose sight of really what's important in life.
So who should we invade? Because what I'm hearing here is that we need an enemy, and we have a lot to choose from. We have a lot of weapons. So what can we do here?
I think we have to discover that we think there's no enemy. And let me relate to an old cartoon, and I'm dating myself. The cartoon is Pogo. And in one cartoon, he comes to the top of a mountain. He looks out at the terrain, and he says, "I found the enemy, and it's us." I think when we realize that we can be our own worst enemy, and we need to start taking a look at how we think, how we feel, how we interact as a human person, and is it giving us value? Is it respecting the value of others? We're going to continue to have this crisis that we're having.
The way I've described it before is that, you know, the world used to hand us monsters to conquer. You know, it used to give us storms. It used to give us famines. It used to give us invaders who, you know, fought with us for limited resources. But now we have to conjure our own monsters and then conquer them. It's like, you know, if you look at these startup guys, you know, you could just as easily earn $300,000 at Google and Facebook, whatever. No. You're going to go and try to live off Cheetos for the next, you know, 2 years because you're going to try to build a company, even though you could be earning hundreds of thousands as a developer. So you're almost recreating or simulating survivalism. And I think that the same thing with people who are, you know, climb mountains or go on these, you know, crazy journeys of self-discovery. I know a guy who's very successful, very wealthy, could definitely have afforded a ticket here today, but didn't show up. And he now has a list that he made of like 200 things. It's almost like a bucket list that he's doing at age 50 instead of waiting till he's too old and he actually kicks the bucket. So he's a guy who's always generating tasks and goals for himself. And I don't think we have that muscle.
Well, I that that begs a deeper question. What is he looking for?
That I think secretly that no matter he's looking what for he a side girlfriend.
No, well,
I don't know about that. No, I'm joking.
But I you understand what I'm saying? What is he looking for that he has to conjure up these things? I don't think he knows. Psychologists say that we're all, as human beings, looking for something. We don't know what that something is, but we are all on a quest for it. And we try to find it in relationships, in money, in fame, in power, you know, you name it, sex, drugs. It goes on and on and on, that search for that missing something. And for me, the answer to that is because we were not made for time. We were made for eternity.
Ooh,
we're transcendent.
Okay.
So there's nothing in time, which is temporary, that can satisfy us. Only eternal things can really satisfy us.
So my theory on his goals is that they would be much more satisfying is if they were directed outwardly towards helping others rather than inwardly towards discovering new things for himself.
That's an eternal value. When you're no longer wrapped in selfishness, and that you understand you're part of something much greater than yourself, and you have a responsibility to others. We are our brother's keeper. When you begin to think outside of, especially in the West, this radical, Western radical individualism, and begin to understand that you are here. If you're given power, it's not for you. It's for those that you can help. When your gifts, talents, and abilities, like Aristotle said, at the intersection where your gift, talents, and abilities meet a human need, that's where you discover your true purpose. When we begin to think like that, we will begin to change our world.
Let's talk about power for a second. First, on a personal level, and then, you know, outwardly. On a personal level, you know, in talking to you, I get the sense that you're a very generous and humble person, and you are not likely to abuse it. However, when you have 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people in the audience, as I would have liked to have today, despite the fire hazard, don't you feel like there's a little bit of temptation that a normal human has, you know, whether it's because of ego or because of, you know, something feeds you this adulation, right? You know, people are validating you in a way that is not normal.
I think that when it comes to power, if you don't respect it, you'll abuse it. I think you should fear power. Have a reverence. When I say fear, I mean have a reverence for power, your ability to influence. Otherwise, you will exploit it. You'll abuse people. And in the process, you yourself don't realize that you're abusing yourself, your talents, your gifts, your abilities. So I put it in perspective. And I think that, you know, number one, you couldn't do what you do without an ego. Ego drives us. That's important. It's a reality. But how we respond to that ego, how we channeled that energy and that drive is important. So all of us, and you know, when we have influence, we have to build into our lives those things that will protect us from ourselves. When I said we've found the enemy and it's us, it's true. You can either undermine your success or empower that success. You can't blame it on someone else, because individually you are responsible at the end of the day. So I build into my life and my operations, my functions, everything, those things that protect me from the abuse of power.
Well, I got that sense. Okay, I'm really comfortable with you having the power now, so I'm okay with that. You made me feel a lot better. You know, I got that sense that you were grounded, because as we sat in your office just for, you know, whatever half hour that we talked, you had at least two grandchildren come in, and they were working in the kitchen, and they were helping out, and they were doing stuff. And I saw that there's this sort of, you know, groundedness in that, you know, that and something that, you know, you feel a responsibility towards, because, you know, you clearly paused whatever it is that we were doing, and you took in what they were saying. So I think that it is part of that Is that important? Like, how much does that play a role in you being this grounded?
Yeah, now you're talking about ritual. You're talking about traditions that are fundamental to human society. You point to Ocasio-Cortez, right? And, you know, her whole idea, she doesn't want to bring, you know, children into this world, et cetera. But how do we perpetuate life? How do we pass things from one generation to another? I've got 24 grandchildren and seven sons. My wife and I will be married in 2 years. We'll, 2022, we'll be married for 50 years. Those are values. Those are traditions that you know, give foundation, stability. I have rules. My grandchildren know that if I'm in the office, even if I'm speaking to someone, they have the right of access, because I don't want them to ever think negatively of what I do. But they know to enter respectfully, ask to be acknowledged by me, and they come in, and I can embrace them, interact with them, and they know they have to leave immediately. But that's all designed specifically, you know, to educate them by example. And they leave with an idea of what love is, what family is, what their value is. You see, these are things that are important to a healthy society.
How do we bring those back, and can we? What is the, aside from a war or an external enemy to bring us closer together, which I'm already working on, and there's a PowerPoint in there somewhere. What is the mechanism by which are people going to flood back to your church? I mean, hopefully after seeing this, they're all going to show up at the door. But the question then is, what is that mechanism? What is the way that you instill something that clearly has been lost? As you sat down with the people who were skeptics and doubters and whatever, they're not wired to hear your message until you sort of break them down. And
see, that's important.
Yeah.
The conversation.
Yeah.
Because with the neuroscientists, I said to him, I said, look, we're talking about faith. I said, you came here tonight because of faith. He said, no, what do you mean? I came because I was invited. I said, no, you trusted that we'd be here. And he said, well, that's too simple. That's ridiculous. I said, no, you trusted that the information you received and everything associated with that information, all right, motivated you in such a way that you were willing to spend the time and effort and money to come from wherever you were. And he was from New York, to come down to this place. He said, no, it doesn't work that way. I said, okay. Faith is a reason, trust. I said, can you live without trust? He said, absolutely. All I need is empirical evidence. I don't, you know, I don't trust anything. And I sat there saying to myself, okay, I got this guy, because his girlfriend must be watching, and he's going to be in serious trouble if he thinks he could have a relationship with a woman,
yeah,
all right, and not have trust. So I, you know, I saw the opening, and I said, well, wait a minute, what about relationships? You need trust in relationship, and this is transcendent. Now when we deal in the realm of faith, hope, love, you know, trust, all right, you can't empirically study that. This is spiritual. These are attributes that transcend the physical and material world, and yet they have very powerful influences on us. And he said, well, I got to think about that. I said, well, take your time, because you're going to need it, especially if you've got a relationship with a young lady out there. This is part of the life experience that science can't explain.
So you haven't answered my question, which is the mechanism. How do we get these conversations? So is it getting off of social media? Is it engaging? Are there ways to engage that we're not doing it?
Okay. It begins with this. And this is why religion is important to me, all right? Because religion gives me a transcendent view of life. It gives me a sense of purpose and meaning, all right? But it also gives me a set of values that guide how I live. It helps me wrestle through the question, not just who or what is God, but what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to live in this world? What does that look like? Religion gives me, based upon study, observation, revelation, and passing on from generation to generation that set of values and structure and order and systems and boundaries, because we need all of that. All right, that is what becomes foundational to a healthy functioning society. Too often we look at religion, so many wars have been fought in the name of religion. No, don't confuse religion in its wholeness, in what it represents as a that tie which binds us together with the divine, with the transcendent, with how people have used it. Mm. Don't misinterpret humans' greed or ambitions, etc., and the use of religion to achieve those ambitions or to satisfy that greed.
Isn't that always the risk? When you have something that is theoretically divine, or, you know, divine as you believe it, then isn't it just ripe for misuse? Isn't it something that now all of these people, because the same book, a white supremacist can read that same book and you can read that book, come to very different conclusions about the world and how to justify certain actions or others.
If I may use a New Testament context.
Please.
So Jesus has this, in the Gospel of Mark, man comes up to him, he's an expert in the law of Moses. And he asks him the question, good master, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Which was interesting, because even within the context of his understanding of the law, there was still something missing. So he said, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus refers back to his expertise, and he says, well, you know the law, you know, honor your mother and father, don't kill, you know, he just goes through these things. But then he asked the important question, how do you read it? Which means that even with religion, we can come to it with clouded lenses. We can come to it with preconceived notions and ideas that have been shaped and fashioned in us by our journey up to that point of being face to face with the possibility of religious belief, you see? And we've got to clarify all of that. So it's a process. It's not just the conversion of the soul, but the conversion of the mind that is necessary. And I think that when we come to faith, to belief, we have to come open, understanding that we're bringing a lot of baggage to it, that we have to go through a process. One of the things that Christianity also presents is that, and this can be observed, right? You can do an empirical study on this, that as human beings, we're all broken, wounded, disordered, and dysfunctional in some way. But deep inside, there is this good, because we hunger for it, we engage in good deeds, we identify good versus evil. You understand? It's there, but it tends to be undermined by that state of woundedness and brokenness and disorder and dysfunction. So even what we create when we design culture, because essentially culture, yes, it's an integrated system of beliefs, traditions, customs, ideas, products, technologies, values. But it essentially is man's attempt to order his society and to determine the best ways to live in it. So out of that brokenness and woundedness, even as we attempt to bring order and meaning, it's still undermined in some way by that condition.
So in this message, are you somehow complimenting or replacing what someone might seek out in therapy, for example? You know, is there a way to fix people with this philosophy, with this outlook and recognizing your brokenness and, you know, creating some sort of order? Can I do that through faith rather than doing it through therapy? Because faith, I think, is more affordable.
I do it every Sunday, free of charge, every Sunday. People come. What did you say? You sat there, yeah. You listened.
Yeah.
You were challenged.
Yeah.
But you left with hope.
Yeah.
There was a sense of, wow, okay, life can be better. I can think differently. And what would life be without hope?
All right, that's it for this episode. If you want to hear the full Q&A, including the pastor's comments on Michael Bloomberg, to whom he's an advisor, just go over to Patreon, patreon.com/McFuture. And don't forget, share the podcast with a friend, subscribe,
tell your family, do whatever it takes to promote me. I'm kidding. Thanks again for listening. I'm Steve Factor. See you next week on The McFuture.